Welcome to the Second Thought podcast, which today was provoked by a broadcast on the 30th of April 2025 by one Giles Fraser, a West London vicar. By way of recap, Second Thought is the self-appointed accuracy police of Thought for the Day broadcasts on Radio 4. These are each 3 minutes of a religious person, and each example purports to be reflections from a religious perspective on events and people in the news. It's my view that these broadcasts are riddled with errors of fact and of reason that should not be tolerated by the BBC. Indeed, it's my view these broadcasts, or at least a majority of them, run afoul of the BBC's own editorial standards, which demand due accuracy. We also find preparing and recording these a tremendous amount of fun. In each podcast, I attempt to include as much of the original broadcast as necessary for the criticism of it to make sense. There was very little of the broadcast from Vicar Giles that did not contain errors of fact or reason, so most of it you can hear in what follows. However, I edit this and it's not always the entire thing, so please visit the Thought for the Day website at the BBC to listen to the original, or you can link to it from secondthoughtfortheday.com. We'd not want you harbouring any suspicions that we were in any way joining the efforts of these godly brothers and sisters as they seek to pull wool over eyes. Here's what the Reverend Fraser said on the 30th of April.
It was the biggest power cut in recent memory. All across Spain and Portugal, the lights went out, people were stuck in lifts and on trains, internet and mobile phone coverage went down, businesses suffered. It wasn't quite mass panic, but it was near enough. Isn't it extraordinary how our society has become so thoroughly dependent upon something that little more than a century ago most people had never even heard of?
Well, Giles, where to begin? How about with a parallel tale of technological breakdown? In London, in 1852, 273 years ago. Now, for context, Queen Victoria was about a third into her 63-year reign. Huge wealth was flowing into London from the British Empire. Great Ormond Street Hospital, Britain's first children's hospital, just opened, as had King's Cross Station, which instantly became the biggest railway station in Europe. And of oblique reference, a patent for the flush toilet was granted that year. The City of London was growing, and it had a water supply system built on centuries of innovation and expansion, and it was working hard to keep pace. 1852 saw the introduction of a new and highly effective filtration system that markedly improved the quality of water delivered to Londoners. But then, thanks to the diligent detective work of one Dr. John Snow, a deadly cholera outbreak was linked to a water pump in Soho. How could it be, with all this technology and a new filtration system, a seemingly simple fault resulted in contamination for a whole neighbourhood? No doubt, West London vicars had letters published in the newspapers sounding caution over these technological advances. All the promise of clean, high-quality drinking water, and it comes crashing down following a single fault. Where to get water now? How did the city become so overwhelmingly dependent on this vulnerable pump network for something as important as its water? Except no, I very much suspect they did not. The cholera problem was identified and the contamination was addressed. Within a decade, London's water treatment and distribution system was complemented by the most advanced sewerage network the world had ever seen. This progression of sanitation technology improved the quality of life for thousands of Londoners, likely also preventing the deaths of thousands more. The benefits of the advances made in the 19th century were very often both vast and visceral. Many more people lost their lives in 1852 London as a result of the contaminated pump than did as a result of the Iberian power outage. But the scale of that power delivery network on the Iberian Peninsula would have been near impossible for the average 1852 resident of Soho to comprehend. Covering almost 600,000 square kilometres, including hundreds of power stations and millions of homes and businesses. And because of that scale, millions more were affected in much more trivial ways by the power cut than the cholera. Now, the outage was huge and an unusual failure for Western Europe. It's not so unusual to hear of the larger cities in Venezuela, South Africa, or India to suffer intermittent blackouts. And variously, these are always attributed to aging infrastructure, supply constraints, and underinvestment. But in fairness, the first two clearly are just euphemisms for the third. Spain and Portugal, though? Not so much. It was a reminder of our vulnerability. Now, much more is known today than at the time about the causes. It'll be in 2026 that the official investigation will report, and this will have valuable information in it for power grids the world over, for the enhancement of resilience, the importance of preparedness, and the importance of trusting good people to maintain cool heads under pressure. It took 10 hours to fix the power cut. It was massively inconvenient for the millions affected. But that was dwarfed by the impact on the family and friends of the six people who died. For comparison, it took 15 days to remedy the cholera outbreak. 616 people died. And even at that point, it was a natural flight of the population away from the affected area that stifled transmission, not the intervention of any authority. The pump itself wasn't disabled until days later. This was because the technology of the time had yet to confirm the germ theory of disease. Disabling a water pump when cholera was thought to be caught from miasma or bad air was not straightforward in 1852 London. Because of technological advances we've made, today we have reliable, clean drinking water from every tap in every house. We heat our homes in winter without life-shortening consequences of breathing wood smoke, or the city-strangling consequences of billowing smoke from a chimney on every rooftop. Each year we manage to do this with less contribution to the causes of global warming. We have astonishingly capable hospitals with emergency backup systems, all of which are the results of millions of aggregated advances in technology since 1851 and before. By way of example, in 1885, we developed the first ever cholera vaccine, pertinently enough for this story, by a Spanish doctor called Juan Ferrani Oclua. The antibiotic, doxycycline, was discovered by Pfizer scientists in the early 1960s. It remains the primary antibiotic treatment today for shortening the course of the disease. Technology that we've developed in medicine, physics, nutrition, sanitation, engineering, construction, chemistry have resulted in things like an astonishingly low global infant mortality rate, the lowest it's ever been. It results in 80% of the world's one-year-olds having been vaccinated against at least one disease, in the number of deaths from natural causes halving in the last 100 years. Technology's also had a dramatic impact on global average life expectancy. If you were born in 1800, on average, on Earth, you could expect to live to the ripe old age of 29. By 2025, that number had risen to 70. The whole planet today has the average life expectancy at birth of those born in the UK in 1956. Counterintuitively, all those 69-year-olds in the UK today who were actually born in 1956 will, on average, live another 16 or so years. This is because infant mortality was a disproportionately active member of the mortality family until relatively recently. In 1965, Britain, 24 in 1,000 live-born children would fail to survive infancy. By 2015, this number had been beaten back to just 4 in 1,000. The benefits of technological development just keep landing. And we don't have to go back to the 1800s or the 1950s to find the contrasts. The momentum of this global technological development has reshaped very recent history. By way of illustration, in 1980, 40% of the world's population lived in a low-income country. Today, that number has not halved. It's halved twice. Only 10% of the world's population today lives in a low-income country. All in my generation learned about the developing world and the developed world, and these labels have long been past their use by date. By any measure, our world is a much better place to live than at any time in the past. Those numbers are little short of astonishing. But they seem, shall we say, inconvenient for many commentators. For some, painting the world as relentlessly bad and in unstoppable decline presents the perfect backdrop to whatever woo or ancient wisdom or god that they're looking to promote. Now, journalists can fairly be accused of committing this offence far more frequently than Thought for the Day presenters. They generally, though, are not flogging crystals, Reiki sessions, or sermons by candlelight. Its prevalence in news media appears to be a consequence of a long-building preference for news that is bad. It happens so much, it has a name, declinism, which is a logical fallacy defined as the belief, contrary to objective evidence, that a society or institution is in decline, commonly resulting from cognitive biases where the past is viewed more favourably than the future. Rose-tinted hindsight, perhaps. I covered this a little in episode 08, in response to Lucy Winkett recounting exclusively horrific news stories to reinforce some guff she was attempting to string together about Good Fridays. I wrote then that this seemed understandable. One might suppose that if people were convinced that modern life were terrible, then you'd be better placed to offer your ancient religion from a simpler time to people as a means to find solace from hardship and pain. I almost wonder if Giles somehow heard this without realising it was criticism. When anyone seeks to advance their own views by making a general contrast between how bad things are now compared to some time earlier, they are engaged in deceit. The truth is that we are healthier and wealthier than at any time in human history. We have more free time, we have more education, all because of these advances in technology. Despite all the parallel advances that we've made in weapons and defence technology, we also live in a time of unprecedented peace, much as you'd never believe that from looking at the news. Battle-related deaths have been at around 2 in 100,000, as a global average, for decades. This is astonishingly low. In 1960, that rate dropped below 5 per 100,000 for the first time since before 1900. By 1971, it had dropped to 2 in 100,000, and it's stayed there ever since. So consider this. Fraser has a problem with technology? Or does he have a problem with his own inability to make appropriate use of technology? All our breakthroughs can be used for good or ill. If the problem is choice, is a bad vicar blaming his tools?
Because all this technology can also be a terrible distraction. That still small voice of calm is often frazzled by the introduction of shiny new tech. I suppose that's why many find their God out on a walk in the sunshine or playing in the garden with their children. These technological breakdowns remind us of the way our society is now inextricably bound up with a technological complexity that rules our lives. Yes, technology enables us to achieve so much more than our ancestors. It creates wealth, puts food on the table, allows us to communicate with people all around the world, saves people's eyes. But I also have some sympathy with those who think we are addicted to it and can never be completely free while so deeply enmeshed within it.
Terrible distraction. Or wouldn't you rather be distracted by technology than by hunger, by disease, or by how you barely knew your parents before they died, or by choosing which of your daughters will die because you can only afford antibiotics for one of them, or by the randomness of death from childhood diseases, or by the superstition and hate that develops from ignorance? Am I being unfair? I'm not sure I am. Giles is clearly aware that technology is more than just the phone in his pocket. He mentions the broad benefits that it's delivered, like food and wealth, yet listen to him talk about people not being free. From what do these people want freedom? Social security? Health? Long life? Clean drinking water? These are the kind of naive comments you can forgive from an idealistic sixth former, but not from anyone. Given an opportunity to speak to millions for 3 minutes on a Wednesday morning via the BBC on Radio 4 in the middle of the Today programme. We are not just enmeshed by the products of our technological advances. We are, for significant part, only alive because of these advances, and we live objectively better lives because of all the technology we've developed. We'd certainly not be able to lead the healthy and prosperous lives that we do, benefit from the culture, sport, hobbies that we take for granted, if it were not for technology that apparently creates such reason for such complaint.
Back in the 90s, I used to be the chaplain of an Oxford college where the chapel didn't use electricity. It was lit exclusively by candles. Some thought this was deliberately arcane, and perhaps it was, but there was a lovely simplicity about that space that some modern churches, with all their reliance on overhead projectors and whizzy sound systems, don't quite manage to capture, and that includes my own, I confess.
I feel that Giles really hasn't thought this through. Perhaps he's commenting only on the technology that he feels is somehow intrusive for him, that is somehow a drag on his plans and his ideals. His smartphone, perhaps, and the imperfect environment in his church, for which he blames some speakers and a projector. Clearly, it doesn't bother him too much, or he'd have had them removed. He has a choice to make. There's no fault here at the door of technology. Now, if he wants to conduct services in a shrine to a pre-industrial world, what's to stop him? If he decides, though, that he and his church will achieve their objectives better with a sprinkling of the fruits of technological development, then he needs to be a little more honest about the choices he's made, rather than indulging in meaningless nostalgia and kicking up a blame storm at technology. Fraser also claims that technological complexity rules our lives. Is that a fair claim? Seems unlikely. Sure, it's all but impossible to opt out of modern medicine, artificially extended winter days, planes, trains, and automobiles, but why would you? But are we ruled by those ties? Am I ruled by the utilities that supply my house? Am I ruled by my ownership and the running of a car? Am I ruled by the perfect coffee I'm able to make effortlessly every morning at the press of a button? Or by the dishwasher that saves me hours each week? No, I'm freed by them. I have more choice because they exist. But I have just strawmanned that argument. Fraser didn't claim that technology rules our lives, as I argued against. He claimed that technological complexity rules our lives. Don't get me wrong, I think Giles is away with the fairies here too, but this claim raises a topic that I think does merit some attention. My father recently became a widower. 70% of his life was spent in a marriage to my mother. Now, it's sad that she's no longer with us, but it wasn't unexpected, and by the end, Dad had been a full-time carer for many, many months. Now, he's gradually rediscovering his life in the community where he lives, which has involved showing up at various gatherings put on for those of a similar vintage. He was never one for joining things, but a neighbour managed to rope into joining a session on how to use phones and computers. My father found it very rewarding. Not because he was lacking, although had you asked him beforehand, he would have said he was, but because he spent the entire time showing others how easy and intuitive their phones were, with just a few prods in the right direction. My father has two children who are much more than averagely able to navigate technology, so he's never been more than a phone call away from a helpful guide. It feels to me that my father's generation has done a solid job of getting to grips with the complexities of technology. My dad stripped and rewired several family homes. He fitted a central heating system to one of them. He knew how to set the time on a VCR so that one, it didn't permanently flash 12, and two, it was possible to program the thing to do the job for which it had been purchased. Typing, though, was not something with which he ever became familiar. He was given a laptop by his employer in the early 90s. It was only used when absolutely necessary. Now, Dad had no difficulty using the famous menu interface of the Nokia phones, but at no point did he develop any understanding of the WIMP environment that dominates computers today. Windows, icons, mouse, pointer. The modern smartphone has done a masterful job of replacing the mouse and the pointer with the tip of a finger, and if you'll forgive the expression, reframing the role of windows. It's brilliantly intuitive as an experience. The architecture, though, that underpins all of the software design in our phones is firmly rooted in WIMP. What is often called intuitive software is perhaps just software that makes sense to people with a rich experience of using operating systems developed by Microsoft and Apple. Most people I know today who get the most out of their Macs and their smartphones and their Windows computers retain a knowledge of things like DOS and Unix, which are what predated the graphical user interface operating systems of Macs and Windows 3.1. The touchscreen made the whole environment much more accessible, but I believe there are some fundamental concepts that dictate how that environment functions, which are as alien to some as they are familiar to me. And this can easily manifest itself as impenetrable technological complexity. There is a need for a few more like my dad who can bridge the understanding gap between Gen X and the boomers, between those who've spent an entire working life on a keyboard and for those for whom keyboards were exclusively for paperback writers and secretaries. We do need to be cautious of age being presented as too much of a factor. I've got contemporaries with less ability to use their phones and their Macs than my dad. These two managed to spend careers not having to spend countless hours operating machines running Windows and whatever version of OS X. Smartphones made ubiquitous this age-old software environment. And perhaps what we just need is a little more thought on how to ensure all the software is as fundamentally intuitive as the touchscreen interface. Just another example of a challenge where careful thought, policy, education, and design can help deliver all of society the experience of freedom, convenience, and enrichment that a smartphone can offer. To dismiss the challenges of this complexity as tyrannical or oppressive is to fail to understand the nature of the challenge. I suspect, though, it's much worse than that. What I suspect it really is a failure of curiosity, a failure of wonder, and ultimately, a failure to care. Lest we forget, back to Fraser, who is now consumed with the musings of some academic French theologian.
The French anarchist theologian Jacques Ellul argued that the problem with technology is that it comes to mediate everything we do in the name of efficiency, and because of this, something about simply being is lost. Technology, he said, has become the new sacred.
Really? Everything I do is mediated by my technology, by my flat-screen TV, by humanity's ability to treat cancer, by the quality of the clean water in my taps, and by the game Angry Birds on my iPhone. And all of this technological mediation is in the name of efficiency. Hogwash. Seems probable that your anarchist, Giles, was making reference to a very specific instance of technology. Now, if he wasn't, he is full of BS. If he was, you failed to relay his comments in appropriate context, rendering them meaningless. Now, let's imagine Ellul had something sensible to say, and he was commenting on something specific, something that chimes a little with the points that he's seeking to land. Corporate email, perhaps. If so, still claptrap. So assuming you've sorted out your big idea and how you're going to finance it, business is about getting things done. If you're paying for someone's time, you need them to be busy, but not for its own sake. You need that busyness to be effective. Now, if email is more effective than Royal Mail, there's going to be a switch. Now, will there be challenges with a wholesale business overnight adoption of an instant electronic messaging service that is effectively free to use? Oh, yes. Now, have many of those been worked out by software writers, by experience, and by thoughtful practice? Yes. Now, if Ellul wrote these comments between 1996 and 2006 about corporate email, I can see where he may have been coming from. There was a tragedy of the commons. Email took no effort to use, and it was instant. So it was abused. It took businesses time to work out how to keep the advantages without incurring the burden on staff of 300 emails a day, of which perhaps 30 were necessary. Good businesses good leaders and good people worked this stuff out. No doubt there are many workplaces that are stuck in the 90s, but that's a them problem. And in any event, none of this is a technology issue. It's a use issue, one that can be solved and has been solved to a greater extent with thought, policy, and education. Let's revisit that near enough mass panic that Giles described in relation to the Iberian power outage. Now, Madrid, the largest city affected, rolled out PENAM, which is this emergency plan. They had a plan, the plan worked. Now, in parallel, the power companies systematically identified, isolated, and fixed the power supply problems. All the power was back on within 10 hours. A vast amount of that recovery would be automatic. Spain and Portugal were automatically isolated from the international grid. The nuclear power stations in Spain and Portugal disconnected from the Iberian grid automatically. The re-energization of the system over four countries, Spain, Morocco, Portugal, and France, was a dance of automation and standard operating procedure. Yeah, trains stopped and had to be evacuated. Most challenging of these were city subway services. Sure, extra police were needed in some cities, but predominantly to help control traffic in the absence of signals. And while backup systems kicked in for hundreds of hospitals, much business and communication did come to a halt as the outage affected internet infrastructure and cell towers. There were reports of fear and confusion. Well, you'd kind of expect that. But there were just as many reports of streets and terraces developing a cheerful ambiance, a near festive mood. In fairness, Giles broadcast his comments barely 48 hours after the outage began. He'd have had almost no reliable information on what had happened, and he'd have had basically what the news providers felt was newsworthy and what the trolls thought was clickbait. This should have tempered his report of the incident, but I'm not sure it did. Fraser did, though, close with these sentences.
But I wonder if there were some people who, freed from the tyranny of the internet and the train timetable, found a surprising lightness. Or something else, maybe. I wonder if there'll be a spike in the birth rate in 9 months' time. For a moment, perhaps, something had lifted, where older gods and more human pleasures could be given the time and the space that they require.
That closing comment would prove to be much closer to the mark than those with which he opened. Yet he was happy to indulge groundless speculation. Indeed, he led with his groundless claim of near enough mass panic. Likely, I imagine, because it provided a convenient bridge to the rubbish he was planning to spew about technology. But technology, again here, is conflated with business. The tyranny of the internet and the train timetable. Cobblers. In this case, trains and a data connection were in the service of paid work. Almost all of us work. We sell our labour or the fruits of it. Now, Noam Chomsky would have us believe that a job is a form of tyranny. There are powerful counter-arguments, but if there is any tyranny in the situation upon which Giles comments, it's a perception amongst employees that the boss is a tyrant. Not that the internet is a tyrant or that train timetables are tyrants. It was the legitimate reason people unexpectedly had to sack off work and head out for a beer that resulted in the lightness. History is dripping with examples of people coming together in adversity and shared purpose. The leap that Giles made instead to tech tyranny was, at best, willfully stupid. If he's right about the birth rate, I can imagine this coming at something of a cost. So there's a load of commuters, freed from the office, taking to the nearby bars and restaurants as they improvised alternatives to heading home to their loved ones. Let's hope that Fraser's contemplation of this esprit de corps benefited from one other vital technological development, that of birth control. Let's also look at those reports of fear and confusion, and what we might learn from needlessly adding to them. Within 23 minutes of the blackout starting, there were reports on social media that it was a Russian cyber attack, falsely attributed to CNN, the European Union, and the utility companies. All completely false. Malicious or thoughtless actors stirring chaos while commuters, families and students calmly dealt with pitch-black underground trains with locked doors and no air conditioning to ensure everyone was safely evacuated in the absence of platforms in kilometres of unlit tunnels. Fear and confusion? Yes, because some like to spread fear and confusion with lies and propaganda with little thought of the consequences. Others, Giles, just calmly got on. Talk about having your perspective and priorities out of kilter. Thought for the day is billed as providing religious perspective on people and events in the news. This is the religious perspective for which Thought for the Day exists. This is just ill thought out, rambling and disinformation. It has no place in the output of the BBC. Unfortunately, he was not yet done.
We worship it and the tech moguls who supply it. Every new app promises a kind of salvation, every gadget a better way of living. But is my fancy smartphone just a tool for me to use, making life easier, more efficient, or am I its slave, its servant? Are the new solutions we find to many of life's challenges just creating a new network of constraints to trap us?
We worship technology? What the... Fraser, did you realise that you were 20 seconds short and started jotting down any old rubbish? Worship of technology, salvation through software. Please, be serious. And the moguls, Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk, are among the least liked individuals on Earth. Now, maybe I missed a meeting. Does Tesla now recharge churches? Does Facebook now do God Book? Now, the worship of tech as hyperbolic rhetoric is tolerable if fanciful. Worship of the moguls who supply that tech is a preposterous suggestion, and he didn't suggest it, he claimed it as fact. Now, there are some interesting examples. Bill Gates and Steve Jobs are the two that spring to mind. Individuals who managed to capture the imagination of some section of the public. Both, if not worshipped, were revered and fetishized. With Gates, it was mostly focused on his wealth, which in 9 years from 1991 grew from just $5 billion to over $100 billion. With Jobs, it was more layered. He had an astonishing turnaround story, but there was also an air of the unconventional and a drive to bring beauty, elegance and joy to products that for 30 years or more had been uninspiring beige and black boxes. But worship? No. Not even close. Now, as for whether slave or master, that's on you, you muppet. Your decisions, your strength of character. Now, enough projecting your flaws and bad choices on the tech bros and the shiny toys they make. Now, if you're trapped in some new network, good to hear that you've identified the problem. Surely you're now halfway to solving it. Now, guys, get on and do that. But please, enough with broadcasting your journey. Thought for the Day is not a self-help slot, although I can imagine it would be incalculably better if it were, which illustrates just how low the bar is set by this brainless simpering. Well, thank you for listening to Second Thought. Thank you also, I guess, to Giles Fraser for providing so much into which we could so easily get teeth. For details of what this podcast is and why I do it, for show notes, links and transcripts, please visit secondthoughtfortheday.com or search for Second Thought for the Day and subscribe, like and comment wherever you get your podcasts. Now, if interested in some background, please listen to the very first Second Thought podcast, which outlines the target of the criticism and my objectives. Complaints levelled at Thought for the Day are typically that the content is boring and repetitive or that it is insufficiently diverse, being mostly Christian, never secular, and perhaps even falling short of the BBC's requirements for impartiality. My complaint is something else. The BBC is not only required to maintain due impartiality, but also due accuracy. It's my view that the BBC fails in its duty to hold Thought for the Day to any standard of accuracy. Typically, these failings take two forms. The first is simply a failure to relay facts faithfully, or to present as fact something that is merely conjecture or belief. The second failure is one of reason. Logical fallacies litter many Thought for the Day broadcasts. Every logical fallacy distorts truth, and any deviation from the truth is by definition an example of inaccuracy. Now, I'm not here to mock faith or the faithful or religion, but clearly I do when justified. But mostly, the podcast is here to shoot holes that deserve to be shot in the false premises, unsupported claims, hanging comparisons, non sequiturs, and any other logical fallacies that we find the BBC has allowed Thought for the Day to trot out.